tomorrow and Thursday, and you can pick up his book, Love First. Okay, so Don McLaughlin is talking about the problems of racial division in America now and looking down the road, where we're going and how we're going to need to get there. What I want to talk about today is where we've been and how we got to be in this sad, sorry state. And I don't have all of the answers or explanations to this. I'm just trying to understand how it is that people came to a place in their minds where they could read the Bible and they thought that the only defensible biblical position was segregation. How did that become an entrenched idea? So I'm trying to read the history of an idea. And to start with, I've sent around a handout that's an article from the Gospel Guardian, which was a very conservative Church of Christ paper published in Texas. This is October 1954. Come on in. 1954 was a momentous year in the history of civil rights and race relations in America. What happened in 1954? Brown versus Board of Education decision came down from the Supreme Court. And after that decision was handed down, the Christian Chronicle ran an editorial in which they said, it's about time, and we need to choose between segregation and Christianity. And then we have a preacher who was at the time in Houston, Texas, Brian Vinson, who wrote this article in the Gospel Guardian in response to that editorial. Now, the article he wrote was 4 pages. I've condensed it for your convenience down to 2, and I won't read the whole thing. But you'll see he's responding directly to a Christian Chronicle editorial about the Brown v. Board of Education decision. And he says that editorial was wrong. He says, the court, this is the second paragraph on the page, the court is not a body that sits in judgment on what is Christian or not Christian. They are not an ecclesiastical court. He says in the middle of that same paragraph, is this a legitimate position to take, the position of the Christian Chronicle, that we should go along with the court and abolish segregation? He says, if it were, if so, one could conclude that, quote, as many of you have been baptized into Christ, have put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus, end quote. You recognize that verse from Galatians 3:28. If the Supreme Court is right, and if the Christian Chronicle is right, then this verse in Galatians 3:28 would suggest that no distinction or segregation of the sexes can be practiced. To which I say, now, brother, you're getting it. Because when we slice and dice the people of God so that some are more equal than others, all of these things are bound up together. But he cannot even imagine on his radar screen that there will ever come a time in churches of Christ where we will be discussing the possibility of women elders or women preachers. That seems like a farcical question to him. And so he suggests that the slippery slope is obviously precipitous and dangerous. So he's focused on the question of black-white relations. So turn the page, and at the top of the second page, that an integrated society is inherently wrong. To be inherently wrong, it must be wrong in the very nature of itself. If this be true, God enjoined and practiced this wrong for 15 centuries in segregating the Jews. So if segregation, if integration is wrong, then God, if segregation is wrong, then God enjoined and practiced this wrong, namely segregation, for 15 centuries in segregating the Jews as a separate people. Furthermore, Christ, the founder of Christianity, sanctioned this segregation by restricting himself and his disciples to the lost sheep of the house of Israel in his ministry on earth. Of course, he's reading the gospel according to Matthew and conveniently overlooking the gospel according to Luke, which has a different perspective on these things. In the next paragraph, he goes to Acts 17, verse 26, to which we will return later. He says, quoting this verse that Paul's speech on Mars Hill, God hath made of one blood all nations of people for to dwell in the face of the earth, and has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitations that they should seek after the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him. He says, there's an endorsement for segregation. God has appointed their boundaries of their habitations. And then, a little farther down the same paragraph, God did disperse, separate, and set the bounds of men's habitations. God made different races and endowed each with its own peculiarities of color, physiognomy, and mental traits and qualities. I want to come back to that idea. Where did he get the idea that it's not just a matter of skin color, but of physiognomy and mental traits and qualities that distinguish different types of people? But God dispersed people, so you're thinking about an echo of the Tower of Babel story and of the Table of Nations in Genesis 12. Finally, in the last paragraph, he tips his hand to what really bothers him. The question before us in this hour is not segregation or Christianity. That was the title of the Christian Chronicle editorial, Segregation or Christianity. That's not the question. He says, rather, it is segregation or miscegenation. Within a very few generations of non-segregation, there shall be inevitably a widespread mixing and mongrelizing of the two races by intermarriage. Can't make it more plain than that. But isn't the choice of language interesting? A mixing and mongrelizing of the two races, something is going to be irreparably damaged. If we allow folks to intermarry across race lines, and we're going to create a bunch of mongrels. I'm interested in the history of this idea. How did a preacher in the Church of Christ come to this point of view? The story is long and sad and ugly, and I'm going to give some highlights. In 1904, W.E.B. Du Bois, in the opening of his Souls of Black Folks, said that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. He looked at that as the most formidable difficulty, the challenge that we face, that will be long and intractable and difficult to solve. They're going to figure this out in a minute. If we could get up the slide, I'd have a quote from another writer from 1914, just a few years after Du Bois, Madison Grant. Has anybody heard of Madison Grant? Yes, Tanya's heard of Madison Grant. Has anybody been to the Bronx Zoo? Good zoo? Best zoo. Madison Grant was the founder of the Bronx Zoo. Good guy, right? Madison Grant wrote a book in 1914 in which he said that the biggest problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. But he was not thinking about it the way Du Bois was thinking about it. He was thinking about it from a Jim Crow segregationist point of view. Say our greatest problem, the greatest danger, and we're going to have to face this because our country has fallen apart, is that we have too many dark-skinned people in this country and we risk intermarrying and watering down the pure genetic bloodline of good old white Americans. So he set out to write a thick book on the different types of people that there are in the world. And he had no credentials to write such a book. Sure, he was founder of the Bronx Zoo. He was on the board of the New York Zoological Society. But he was a lawyer by training. But he wrote a thick book on what purported to be anthropology, in which he made this case. Where did this idea come from? We need to back up. How is it that somebody like Brian Vinson or Madison Grant can purport to offer scientific explanations for the way things are and the way things ought to be? Nowadays, when we think about these questions about why, let's put it in their language, why Negroes are different from Caucasians or from white Northern Europeans, the explanations have tended to go toward the old debate between nature and nurture. So which do you think? Show of hands, especially those of you who are parents, you raise children, some of you have seen grandchildren come up. So which is more important? Is it genetic? How many would you say? Is there training? Yeah. So a lot of you are non-committed, and maybe some of you smell a rat because you don't know which way I'm going to go on this. But I think there's been this long conversation, and we need to back up and see how this conversation became a racialized question. But to simplify, perhaps to oversimplify, we might say that nowadays most biologists would emphasize nature in the nature versus nurture. They see there is something about genetics that affects us in surprising and sometimes inexplicable ways. But I don't know that biologists would say it's all genetics, but you can't deny that there's something about genetics that affects us. On the other hand, anthropologists and sociologists will tend to emphasize nature. There's something about the culture, the environment, the social interaction in which a person lives that influences how we think and how we relate to each other. But we need to back up because we're talking about a world of ideas that developed before there was such a thing as anthropology or sociology. Turn that clock back, way back. Here's one of the people I've come to notice lately and appreciate in American history, Francis Lajoie. Does that name ring a bell for anybody? Francis Lajoie was a missionary to the wild, woolly frontier of South Carolina. Came in 1709, sent by the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts, which was a Church of England missionary endeavor. So he was supposed to be planting Anglican churches in this colony in South Carolina, which meant his task was to round up English settlers and get them going to church. And while he was at it, he should be finding French Huguenot settlers and converting them to Anglicanism. And while he was at it, he should be looking out for the Native Americans who were in the area. And while he was at it, he was interested in the slaves on the plantations. We need to make good Anglicans out of these folks. But some of the slave owners were not so sure about Francis Lajoie's intentions or the rationality of what he was up to, and they hesitated. It's interesting to read in the history of early America that it was not a foregone conclusion that white slave owners should Christianize their slaves. most of us have studied this question in American history from the period of the Civil War, and there's a certain rationalization that Christianity has made black people better because, I mean, slavery has made black people better because it introduced them to Christianity, so we pat ourselves on the back, so we made Christians out of them, right? But in the 18th century, it was not a foregone conclusion that that was even a wise or necessary thing. So what we have, fortunately, Francis Lajoie wrote many letters home to his sponsors in the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, giving monthly reports and updates what's happening in the mission in South Carolina. And he chose the story of a conversation he had with one of his parishioners. I'm sure she was a lovely and genteel lady. This was in September of 1711. She spoke to him after church, and she had a question. Reverend Lajoie, is it possible that any of my slaves could go to heaven? And must I see them there? Which strikes me as an interesting two-part question. The first part, is it possible that any of them could go to heaven, raises the question of whether these are actually human beings, right? But on the possibility, let's imagine that she was a broad-minded and forward-thinking Southern lady. And she was willing to entertain the theoretical possibility that these people might be human beings. It would seem to her that propriety would require a segregated cloud in heaven. Surely there would be a rainbow between our quarters and theirs. Must I see them there? She was concerned. Now, this was an environment in which Francis Lajoie was trying to evangelize, and so he worked out an arrangement that he had permission to catechize slaves of the plantations and baptize them and bring them into church on the condition that when he administered baptism, they swore that they understood that their baptism was a matter of entry into the church and that they would in no wise ask for or expect manumission on that account, that they would be good and faithful and obedient slaves. That this was about what was going to happen to them in heaven by and by. It would not affect their status now. And on that condition, the planters allowed him to evangelize the slaves. So, let's see, let's catch up. Since now the pictures have come up, there's W.E.B. Du Bois from 1904. There's our friend. Well, this is a different quotation from Lothrop Stoddard, a friend of Madison Grant. We might as well read it while we're here. The worldwide struggle between the primary races of mankind, the conflict of color, as it has been happily termed, bids fair to be the fundamental problem of the 20th century. There you go, the rising tide. Oh, this is his book on the French Revolution in Santo Domingo. He's writing a history. He actually had a PhD in history from Harvard. So he's actually was trained to do history. So he's writing a history of the Haitian revolt and the war for independence. So he's arguing that the problem of the conflict of color will be the problem of the 20th century. All right, back to our friend in South Carolina in 1711. Or let's pick another friend from the 18th century, Thomas Jefferson, his Notes on Virginia. Was not sure why blacks are different, only that they were different and that they were inferior. So he says the improvement of blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with whites has been observed by everyone and proves that their inferiority is not the effect merely of their condition of life. So it's not just a matter of nurture. It's a matter of nature. Genetics gets in there. Now, he is a horticulturist, an agriculturalist, you know, an experimenter. He understands genetics the way Gregor Mendel understood genetics. He understood you crossbreed plants and animals, and you see what happens. And it's his observation that when blacks mix with whites, blacks get better. And there's proof that that changes things. But that's not all he has to say on the matter. When arguing for ourselves, we lay it down as a fundamental that laws, to be just, must give a reciprocation of right. And it is a problem which I give to the master to solve whether the religious precepts against the violation of property were not framed for him as well as for the slave. And whether the slave may not as justifiably take a little from one who has taken all from him, as he may slay one who would slay him, that would only be fair, wouldn't it? Isn't Thomas Jefferson broad-minded? In 1829, David Walker, published an appeal to the colored citizens of the world, in which he took up Jefferson's suggestion and said, "That's a good idea. I call on colored citizens and slaves everywhere to rise up and kill somebody, and let's be free, and let's take united action." He published that book in 1929. He was a free black man. He was a merchant of used clothing in Boston. Now, Boston will become the center of the abolitionist movement, right? It's the most liberal city in America among all the colonies. He was a free black man in Boston. He published that book in 1829, and curiously, he was dead by 1830. So another quotation from Jefferson, Notes on Virginia. "I advance it, therefore, as a suspicion only, that the blacks, whether originally a distinct race," you see, that's still an open question, "or were made distinct by time and circumstances," so it might be a nurture matter, "are inferior to the whites in the endowments both of body and mind. It is not against experience to suppose that different species of the same genus or varieties of the same species may possess different qualifications. Will not a lover of natural history, then, one who views the gradations in all the races of animals with the eye of philosophy, excuse an effort to keep those in the department of man as distinct as nature has formed them?" Of course, Thomas Jefferson was a deist, so he looks at this as the way nature has arranged things. There are these different categories of people. And I'm not sure whether nature created separate races altogether, or whether these people have just diverged because of climate or cultural context. Is it nature or nurture? I can't explain it. All I can say is, they're clearly different. One is clearly superior, the other is clearly inferior, and nature wants us to keep them apart. Nature wants that. This idea becomes so ingrained, even as late as 1925 in the Churches of Christ. You all know Samuel Robert Cassius? He was a preacher in the Church of Christ, mostly in Oklahoma. He was originally from Ohio. He spent some time in Southern California. And an educator. I tried to found a school in Oklahoma for blacks. He chose Oklahoma because he viewed it as a possibility for an integrated, or at least a territory where blacks could have their own free land and be left alone. He was frustrated and unsuccessful in his efforts to have a school that would be viable, economically viable, but he tried. Bless his heart, he tried hard. He published a book in 1925 called Third Birth of a Nation. If you're interested, you can read it online. It's digitized on the ACU archives, the Digital Commons at ACU, so you can just Google Third Birth of a Nation, in which he argued for anti-miscegenation laws. That's why we don't want to intermarry with white folks. He said he thought it would be a risky and bad idea for a white man to marry a black woman. He probably couldn't handle her. he was serious. But he was not interested in mixing the races in marriage. But he pushed back very hard on that genetic fallacy, this idea that the black man is a beast, is an animal, is a different order, not a human being. He pushed back very hard on that. He took serious issue with that. Let me exit this PowerPoint for just a second.
and I'll come over to a video. This is Fox and Friends 2009. They're going to talk about a recent study on marriage and
the health benefits of marriage.
Yeah, it sounds like a good idea.
Yes. Did you know that being married is healthy for you, at least when it comes to Alzheimer's disease or dementia or things like that? This group did a study. They first interviewed middle-aged people around 50 in the 1970s and 1980s, and then they came back to look at them 21 years later. Those who were married at that point in their life, in the midpoint of their life, ended up having much fewer cases of Alzheimer's than those who were divorced, single.
Okay, the speakers are not working in the system. Could you hear what's coming out of my computer? Study in Sweden, people who are married, long marriages, stay married, have much lower rate of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. Well, that's very interesting. So they discussed that for a little bit, and there's some inane banter, and I will spare you the inanities, but we'll pick up this guy, Brian Kilmeade, one of the co-hosts of Fox and Friends, is sitting there listening to the other two banter about this, but he has thoughts on his mind that he's kind of bursting to get on the table. And finally, there's a break in the conversation, and he weighs in on his thoughts about this.
And they say that if they keep it together, I find this somewhat good. Yeah. To the Finns and Swedes to come up with something. We keep marrying other species and other ethics and
I give her credit. Are you sure you're not suffering from some of the dementia we're talking about? We keep marrying other species and other ethnics. Now, Goff told us this morning, think of the most charitable interpretation you could put on this. He misspoke himself, right? He didn't mean to say other species, right? But my question is, how is it that that's the word that happened to pop into his mind accidentally? Is this a Freudian slip? So he goes on to defend his point, to say the thing is, the Swedes, they are a pure race. They're genetically pure. They marry Swedes, and the Finns marry Finns. And we'll marry anybody in America, and it contaminates the data. So you can't talk about this kind of longitudinal study in marriage relationships because you don't have pure data to work with. I think some marriage therapists would probably question his question. But I want to say that this way of thinking is not eradicated in America. It's still out there. But let's return to the question as it stood at the end of the 18th century. We'll come back to the PowerPoint. You will scarcely ever read from the pen of any Christian, black or white, an argument against slavery or against Jim Crow or against any form of racial discrimination in which Acts 17:26 does not come into play. That is the first and favorite text, the one that was already quoted. Vincent himself said if he's going to make his case, he has to deal with that verse. God is made of one blood, all the people of the earth. But that's not the whole verse. God has also determined the boundaries of their habitations. And this is the half of the verse where segregationists take heart. Isn't it true that God separated people, wanted them to live separately? Isn't it true, if we read Genesis, that God cursed Ham and all his black-skinned descendants to be slaves of the descendants of Japheth and Shem? Don't we read that in Genesis 9, 25 to 27? Have you heard this interpretation? Isn't it true that God appointed the descendants of Japheth to Europe, those of Shem to Asia, those of Ham to Africa? Isn't that what Genesis 10 tells us in the Table of Nations? Have you heard this interpretation? This is not old news. In fact, I dare say we have scarcely heard any other interpretation of these passages. These interpretations of Genesis 9 and 10 were so deeply ingrained in 19th century American thought that they could be satirized. In the Atlantic Monthly in 1889, there was a short story called Dave's Necklace. In the story, there was a slave named Dave who was framed for stealing bacon from a smokehouse, and his master punished him by having the blacksmith fashion iron around a ham, attach the ham to a chain, and put the chain around Dave's neck. 6 months of wearing a ham around his neck, Dave died. And this is the story of the curse of ham. Now, I read this story from 1889, and I'm asking, is this an absurd literalization of a figure of speech, the sort of thing that Edgar Allan Poe would write about the loss of breath, the man who lost his breath? We're just taking a figure of speech and making it absurd satire? Or was this an urban, or maybe we should say a rural legend floating around at the time? Was it based on a rumor? Was it based on a true story? Jacob Stroyer was born in North Carolina. His father was a slave, but his mother was free, and therefore, by North Carolina law, curiously, he was free. And his mama sent him up north as soon as she could. So he stayed free. But he wrote a memoir, first in 1879, the fourth edition was 1898, Sketches of My Life in the South, what it was like growing up down there. And he tells the story of a slave named Jim. He says, this happened on the plantation where I grew up. A slave named Jim was accused of stealing a hog, and the master punished him by tying a ham around his neck and forced him to continue working his regular work in the field with that ham. And Jim died with the ham chained around his neck. Now, the one who falsely accused him of stealing the hog was the son of the plantation owner. And that son found out that Jim had died, and he felt bad about that, and he repented to God, and he asked God to forgive him. But Jacob Stroyer comments, sadly, Jim was not around to forgive him. So Jacob Stroyer tells the story of the thing that actually happened, which makes me wonder whether Dave's necklace was a rural legend or a rumor or a report of this event, or was maybe a common practice. But that's kind of a farcical treatment of Genesis, isn't it? Most folks think about Genesis and they're not in a jovial mood. What's the obvious meaning of Genesis? The obvious meaning that we have inherited was not obvious to ancient and medieval Bible scholars. Ancient interpreters of Genesis recognized that the distribution of portions of the world among Noah's descendants was not strictly according to what we call continents today, but that the sons were dispersed over the continents, you know, irregularly. So just read Josephus. Josephus sees that all of Shem's descendants are represented in Asia, but Ham's descendants are clearly in Africa and Asia. Japheth's descendants are clearly